Well, good evening and welcome to the sixth presentation in this our sixth series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries and the Kentucky Museum. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with my colleague Peggy Wright, with help from Haiwan Wan, our website guru, and Brian Carson, our reference specialist. Our technical specialist tonight is Jason Hatman. The authors Bill Bass and John Jefferson first met in 2003 when Jefferson produced a two-part documentary about the body farm for National Geographic Society entitled Biography of a Corpse and Anatomy of a Corpse. And in part one, John showed what happens to a single body from the moment it arrived at the facility to the final boxing up of the bones. And then in Anatomy of a Corpse, he featured several professionals who had studied with Dr. Bass or had used the body farm's facilities for carrying out their own area of expertise. John told us at supper tonight he's a native of Alabama, a graduate of Birmingham Southern. He's an award-winning writer, journalist, producer whose filmography includes documentaries on America's Most Endangered 2000, The Secret Bunker, about a secret bunker constructed in West Virginia during the Cold War, Empires of Industry, Rockies, a documentary featuring Peter Fonda, and The Vatican Revisited, which featured Mike Farrell and Carl Bernstein. His films have appeared on the Arts and Entertainment Network and the History Channel. He's written articles for the New York Times, Newsweek, USA Today, and Popular Science. And while commenting to his wife about a Knoxville newspaper article about the FBI digging up corpses in a facility in Knoxville, he said to have remarked, "Can you believe there's a facility in Knoxville where they do this kind of research?" "Yes," she answered, "that's Dr. Bass and the body farm. He taught me osteology. And the rest, as they say, is history." The Jefferson-Bass writing partnership has resulted in two nonfiction works, Bass's memoir, Devil's Acre and Beyond the Body Farm. And in 2006, they turned their talents to fiction and have since written four best-selling mysteries. In May of 2008, while speaking in the One City, One Book program in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, they announced their newest mystery in a modern-day robbery in Oak Ridge, stumbles across a murder from the Atomic City's Manhattan Project days. This was published last month as The Bones of Betrayal. And the reviewer for Booklist magazine commented recently, "This series just keeps getting better and better, and the latest installment features both the most compelling story and the best portrayal yet of the protagonist, Brockton." While we regret that Dr. Bass is ill and unable to join us tonight, it's our great pleasure to welcome John Jefferson.
Thank you. Let me start out by just apologizing to all of you who were looking forward to hearing Dr. Bill Bass, my friend and colleague and co-author. I know he's such a treat to listen to, and if anybody wants to leave now, you can. But I brought many things to try to help, at least in part, make up for Dr. Bass's absence. I have visuals galore. What we're going to start out with is the first segment of the National Geographic show, Biography of a Corpse. And let me give you just a tiny bit of backstory on that. Just before I did these shows for National Geographic, I was doing a lot of shows for the Arts and Entertainment Network, A&E. How many of you watch A&E sometimes? So their flagship series is called Biography, or used to be. And so, I'm thinking A&E, and I'm thinking corpses, and pretty natural to think, well, it'd be interesting to tell the life story of one of these research bodies at the body farm. Their life as a research subject really begins at the moment of death, and then it continues for weeks or months as the body skeletonizes, and the graduate student who's working on a PhD or master's project does their research. And then at the end, they literally, in this case, cut off the skull and scrubbed up the bones and measured them and boxed them up. So I thought it would be interesting just to track a research corpse all the way through the project, the research project that it was part of. So that's where Biography of a Corpse comes from. You get to see and hear a little bit of Dr. Bass in this, so there's sort of a consolation prize. And then after we see this first clip, this is like the first 7 or 8 minutes of that show, then I'll show you what happens to this guy that you're going to meet in the first bit. what happened to him over the entire 7 or 8 weeks that we were out there shooting this documentary. We compressed that period of time, almost 2 months, into about a 25-second film. And it's really, really dramatic and remarkable. Now, if you're squeamish, you know, you might want to sort of look through your fingers or turn your head, but it's really fascinating. So I'll let you watch the beginning of this, because it gives you a good idea, if you're not already familiar with it, it gives you a good idea of what the Body Farm is about and what it's like. And it takes you inside the gates, which not a lot of people get to do in person. So,
is a place where death is seen as a beginning.
There's no other place that can document in a laboratory setting the processes that occur in nature during human decomposition.
At the center of this quest for knowledge is the corpse of a selfless individual. His donation, a legacy of flesh and bone, will help unlock the complex mysteries of human decay here at a place called the Body Farm.
Okay, so there's a little intro to the Body Farm. I'll tell you a little bit more about the research subject that we followed through in the documentary. He actually had intended to donate his body to the medical school up at East Tennessee State University, but he died alone, and his body wasn't found until about 12 hours after death. And the medical school has an 8-hour limit. They have to get your body within 8 hours to use you as a cadaver for medical students. So his longtime girlfriend then had this dilemma. She wanted to honor his request that his body be used for teaching and science, but she couldn't give him to a medical school. Luckily, she had heard of the Body Farm and knew that scientific research was done there, so she called the anthropology department, which is the home to the Body Farm, and asked if they would be interested in her donating his body there. Dr. Lee Jantz, who's the woman who talked early in the clip about how this is the only place in the world where you can really observe the processes. Dr. Jantz said to this woman, yes, we would love to have the donation, and she said, I'll just throw this out there, and you are more than welcome to say no, but she said, there's a documentary crew for National Geographic that is just about to start filming, and they'd like to follow a body all the way through. Would you have any interest in being part of that project? And she thought about it for a minute, and she said, you know, I think he would have liked that. She said he loved the human body, he loved teaching people about the body, he loved to show off his physique, and in fact she gave me a lot of pictures of him, sort of posing like Tarzan, He was a lifelong athlete, he was a pentathlete, and I forget what all the events in the pentathlon are, but I know one of them is the javelin throw, because she gave me this picture that was on the front page of the local newspaper of this guy at 70 hurling this javelin, and he really looked like, a 70-year-old Tarzan. He had this sort of mane of white hair and, this physique that, I haven't had for 20 years now. No, actually I never had it, and so she said, I think he would have liked that. And so we started filming with him, and as you saw, he came out of the cooler and went onto the ground. He was known in the documentary and to all the graduate students as 3101, and that's a code. All the donated bodies at the research facility are known by code number. The first number in the sequence, 31, indicates he was the 31st donated body, and the second year indicates the year. So he was body number 31 in the year 2001. And they ended up that year, by the end of the year, they had about 35 or 6 bodies come through. The last 2 years, they've had about 130 bodies each year come through. So the number has gone up dramatically. Now, he was part of a graduate student master's thesis project, and this student was researching whether the presence of clothing has any effect on the rate of decomposition. And that matters in the real world for this reason. About half of the bodies that are found when somebody, when there's a death, either a murder or an unattended death from natural cause, about half the bodies that are found are clothed and about half are nude. But most of the research data that they've gathered in previous years at the Body Farm has studied the decomposition rate and processes of nude bodies. And so this graduate student wanted to know, does that same data apply in the same way? Can we use the same mathematical formulas, because they actually do have a formula that they've worked out through years of research for calculating, you know, what rate a body is going to decay at given certain temperature conditions. So if you remember, when he came out of the body bag, he was wearing a t-shirt and briefs. And now she has put another t-shirt and a pair of cotton sweatpants on him. And she had four bodies. She had a winter body, a spring body, a summer body, and a fall body. He was the fall body. He came out and went onto the ground, I think, on September the 14th, 2001. Let me give you a little bit of background on what you're going to see in this next 25 or 30 second clip. And the way we got this clip is we set up a still camera, a 35 millimeter camera on a tripod, pointing down at him. And the camera was on a timer. And so initially, every 2 hours, it was taking a photograph, day and night. And then after the first week, the temperature cooled off a little bit, and the changes in the body were not as swift. And so we slowed it down to every 6 hours. And then I think by the end, it was every 8 or 12 hours. You'll see him go through four stages of decomposition. There's fresh. If you look closely, you will probably see a fly or two buzzing around his face. Before the students walked away from him, the flies were already flocking to him. Literally within seconds or minutes after death, flies can smell it, blowflies, within a matter of seconds, will find a body and they'll start laying their eggs, generally in the warm, moist orifices of the body, the eyes, the nose, the mouth, the ears, the pelvic openings if they can get there. And if there's a bloody wound on the body, they will lay their eggs in the bloody wounds. We have a police presence here. We have the head of the university police who knows this, but some of you may not know this. If there's a body that's found and one hand is still fully fleshed and the other hand is down to bone, that probably indicates that there was some kind of wound in the hand, a defensive knife wound or something, that opened the flow of blood in the hand and therefore attracted the flies. So the flies lay their eggs. You will see the maggots hatch, especially around the mouth and the nose. And it's waves, enormous waves of maggots. And some of the waves that you'll see, it's almost like pulsing in the video because it's so fast. Part of the wave-like pulsing is because there are successive fly hatches. Part of it is the alternation between day and night, because the bugs don't like to be exposed in the daylight because birds feed on them. And so during the daytime, they tend to crawl inside the body under the skin, and they come out at night. So you'll see this sort of pulsing effect of these successive fly hatches and also the sort of day and night rhythms. You will also see the body bloat up. The first phase of decomposition is called the fresh stage. The second phase is called bloat, and the body, the abdomen swells up enormously as gases build up within the gut. The third stage is called the active or decay stage, and then the fourth stage is called dry. There's no sharp, bright line between those phases, but it's pretty clear without a PhD in anthropology, you'll be able to see when he's in the middle of bloat. And by the end, things are pretty well slowed down, and it's clear that he's in a dry stage. You will also see in the video, you'll see dark stains spreading through his clothing, particularly under his arms and his groin and around his neck. As the soft tissues decay, they tend to liquefy into something called volatile fatty acids, and they cause a dark stain on the ground around the body. It looks almost like oil sludge. Goo is one of the highly technical terms for it. But it kills the vegetation because it is acidic. It's interesting. If we get time, I'll tell you later about some of the science that's in the Newton novel Bones of Betrayal. But one interesting little factoid from that is this. As we decay after death, we tend to give off a lot of carcinogenic compounds, things like benzene and naphthalene and toluene, the kinds of things that an industrial company in Bowling Green, you got caught putting those out into the environment, you'd be in big trouble. But we think we eat healthy and our bodies are temples and all that, but once we kick the bucket, we're toxic. Anyway, so that's sort of what to watch for as this clip plays. I've seen this probably 100 times now, and it always fascinates me. And it's always interesting to me. There's a couple of places where if you look quick, you can see a leaf that's caught in mid-fall, in mid-drop. So anyway,
okay.
We may play that twice.
Okay.
Oh, there, here we go. One thing you may have noticed is there's still skin on the bones. Often the skin will leatherize, essentially, you know, particularly if the body's out in the sun. It becomes very hard and leather-like, and it's actually very hard for the graduate students to clean off when they're cleaning out the skeleton. So what they often do, if they're not using a body for research, if they're simply letting it skeletonize for the teaching collection, is they'll cover it with a body bag, because that keeps the skin from leatherizing. And it also gives the maggots shelter, you know, day and night, so that they can do their work faster, more efficiently. The clip you just saw took 7.5 weeks. Because, as I say, he was in the fall, and the temperature had cooled considerably after the first couple of weeks. Now, there was a body that came in about a week before this guy, when the temperature, you know, there was an extra week of intense summertime heat, and it's heat that's the primary accelerant to human decay. Kind of an embarrassing but funny story about the previous guy. The graduate student, Robin Miller, and I met when the previous body came in. We didn't have the okay to go ahead and start shooting yet, which was too bad, because, you know, here comes this body, and at the beginning of September, when it's still nice and hot, and things were going to happen fast. But I met her out at the body farm for my first visit to the body farm, my first visit with her. The previous body, 3001, came in, and she asked me, could I help her put him out on the ground? Because somebody else was supposed to meet her and assist her, and they didn't show up. So it's just me and the graduate student. I want to get on her good side, you know, because, you know, I'm going to be asking her for favors for the next 2 months. So I said, oh, yeah, sure, I'll help. So we carry him in, and we put him on the ground, and she says, okay, well, now I need to put clothes on him. Can you get a shirt on him? Can you grab his wrists and, you know, raise him up to a sitting position? So I said, sure, yeah. So I'm, you know, straddling the body and leaning over, you know, barking his face, and I lift him up to the sitting position, and she works the shirt over one arm and then the other. And she says, okay, you can put him down now. I mean, this guy is freshly dead. Of course, it's, you know, 90 degrees, so, you know, he's pretty warm. As I'm lowering him down with my face this far from his, I hear this, oh, from the body. I barely managed to avoid soiling myself. And I looked at her for reassurance, and she looked as scared as I was. So I asked Dr. Jantz about it later. She said, oh yeah, that happens a lot, because there's air in the lungs, and as it sort of, as you lay them back down, the air in the lungs goes out over the vocal cords. It's just, you know, like wind on a reed instrument. Anyway, so that was my disconcerting introduction to the body farm. I was a lot more comfortable with things, you know, by the end of it all. Do you guys want to see that again, or did you see enough? Okay, does anybody have any questions about the clip before we play the clip again? Yes, sir.
Talk about the toxic materials related to the body.
Yes.
How does that affect the insect?
They actually have done a study, because one of the questions that naturally arose, you know, after the body farm had been in business for a while, is the research data from here representative of what you would, you know, is the decay rate here comparable to the decay rate of a body that's out by itself, not, you know, in this place that may be saturated with decomposition chemicals, or, you know, where maybe there's this huge, huge fly population just waiting. So they did a research study where they put bodies at other University of Tennessee agricultural campuses at various distances from the body farm, and the decomposition rate was exactly the same. So, you know, it is a natural, you know, an important question to ask. You know, have they skewed the research by concentrating all these bodies here? But apparently they have not. Now they do, however, they do need more space. So, you know, there are 3 acres, and, you know, they've gone from a handful of bodies a year to 130 bodies a year. And so it's getting pretty crowded there. And the university, in theory, has agreed to give another 10 or 15 acres of land. You know, but they're having a hard time finding the right match of land that's also accessible to the anthropology department. Because, you know, if the graduate students have to spend 2 hours getting out to their research experiment and 2 hours getting back, the day is shot. And then, you know, they need to have access to water and electricity, you know, as well. And so they can't have it way up in the boonies for that reason either. They actually have funding to build a new building, you know, a classroom and lab and teaching building, which in fact will be named in Dr. Bass's honor, but they just, you know, they haven't gotten the right place yet to put it, and it's going to cost them hundreds of thousands of dollars just to put a fence around the expanded facilities. I mean, everything is harder than you think it might should be. Yes, ma'am.
Is there a comparable study with those, a deterioration of study, that is, for those who are buried in coffins rather than out?
They have done a study, I think it was a five-year study, sponsored by Batesville Casket Company at the body farm. They buried bodies in coffins. Of course, you know, I mean, there are a lot of variables when you get into that. You know, where's the water table, and is the body embalmed or not embalmed? I mean, they were basically just studying, you know, what happens to coffins, you know, how do the coffins hold up? Do they leak or do they not leak? And how badly do they rust and that sort of thing? So they weren't actually studying the decay rates specifically in those bodies and coffins. You know, now I will tell you that a body that is buried as opposed to one that's on the surface, you know, rule of thumb is if it's a shallow burial, I think it takes 8 times as long to decay, you know, in a shallow grave as it does on the surface, because the insects can't get there to the body. I mean, the maggots are amazing, they really are. Nasty, but amazing. But then, I mean, you know, they're also, I mean, they are to the fly as the caterpillar is to the butterfly. You know, they just sort of, you know, writhe around in nastier gunk. Okay, so let's watch this one more time, and then I'm going to talk about a case that's in Beyond the Body Farm, our second nonfiction book that we did. So it's interesting. I mean, you see some really horrible things happen to this guy. I mean, you know, we tracked him slowly for 45 minutes, you know, to get to the end point there. But then, I mean, what we had found out about this guy was, you know, was so interesting. He sounded like such a great guy, you know, that we hated to leave it, you know, leave him looking so bad. You know, so what we did at the end, after, you know, there's this sequence where you see the bones, you know, clean and being measured for the computer database and boxed up. But then what we did is we went back through all these photographs that his girlfriend had given us. And so, you know, having seen what eventually becomes of him, then you get to see him in his prime, you know, throwing the javelin and, you know, paddling the canoe and, you know, sitting on his woodpile, you know, with his, you know, with his chin in his hands, with his big grin, and, you know, it's just some, you know, it was almost like, you know, he got his life back, which was a really nice thing for his girlfriend, and actually for those of us who, you know, who got to know him. A fascinating project to get to work on. So I'm going to talk about a case now that. Forensic case that is in Beyond the Body Farm. This is a case that that we gave 3 chapters to because it was so amazingly convoluted. You know, every time we thought it was done, some new twist would happen. This is a woman named Leoma Patterson who went missing from Clinton, Tennessee, a small town about 20 miles from Knoxville. She disappeared. She was last seen leaving a bar in Clinton with 2 men. And then about 6 months later, along the shore of a nearby lake in a neighboring county, a dog dragged some bones into a yard. And so they went out and they searched on the shore. Oh, wait, I got to stand here. So they searched along the shore of this lake, and they found a skull and a rib cage, and that's a humerus, an arm bone. It had to have been late 70s because he's not wearing gloves, so this is pre-AIDS. This is a medical examiner named Dr. Cleland Blake. This is not Dr. Bass. Dr. Bass, unfortunately, was not called to this scene back in the late 70s. Now this, I don't know, this is just some sticks and logs, and I'll show you a close-up of that. That is what's called a hair mat. You know, within about 5 to 7 days after someone's killed and left in the woods, the hair sloughs off, along with scalp tissue as a single piece, the mat. And particularly in cases where animals have scavenged the body or the bones, often the dogs will take the skull off somewhere, and drag a lot of the other bones off. But they don't tend to be very interested in the hair mat. And so often, the two best ways to tell where the body actually initially was and where the decomposition began is to look for the hair mat and then also to look for the volatile fatty acid stain. The dark stain. How many of you listen to Prairie Home Companion? The powder milk biscuits, the dark stains indicating freshness. Anyways, you'll never hear that line again quite the same way. Okay, so this is the hair mat, now this is the skull, and you can see there's still some leatherized tissue on the skull, but you can also see where the hair mat and part of the scalp sloughed off. And this is another view of the skull. And so the medical examiner cleans the bones off. It's nice and white and clean. And it gives her his number, which is not the same as the body farm system of numbering. So this is the skull, the mandible, the lower jaw. The humerus, and that's one of the femurs. And those, plus some vertebrae and some ribs, are about all that was left. Most of the long bones have been scattered and chewed up by dogs. There was also this dress found. And now, not all of this jewelry was found at the death scene, but a couple of these rings, including this one, this turquoise ring, were found there. And so what the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation agent did, who was working the case, is he had the two pieces of jewelry that were found at the death scene, and he got other pieces of jewelry from other women who worked at the courthouse, and he did sort of a jewelry lineup for members of the family, of the Patterson family, the woman that they thought it might be. And so, although some of the family said, oh no, she never wore a ring, a couple of them said, well yeah, that turquoise ring was hers. So on the basis of the skeletal, the anthropological information, and it was a middle-aged white female, and the dress and the jewelry, the medical examiner made a tentative identification that yes, these were the bones of Leoma Patterson, this woman who went missing in Clinton. And so she's buried in the family cemetery, which is way up in the hills of Anderson County, up in the edge of the Cumberlands, a really remote area. But as time goes by, some seeds of doubt within the family took root. And a number of her daughters, she had seven kids, and a number of them decided, well, I don't think that was Mom. And so one of her granddaughters was a student at the University of Tennessee, and she heard Dr. Bass guest lecture to her chemistry class. And so she said, and she was a CSI fan. And so she thought, well, I bet Dr. Bass could help us figure out if that really was Grandma. So she, they talked it over in the family, and they decided to see if Dr. Bass could help settle the question once and for all. About 3 years ago, Dr. Bass and I went up, and the coffin was exhumed, and this is, you can tell this coffin leaked. There's all this mud in there, there wasn't much in the way of tissue left to decompose. So this is all just seepage into the coffin. And you can see there's the skull and then some ribs and some vertebrae, and there's the femur down there. So she's in the coffin in kind of sort of anatomical order. And this is Dr. Bass, to help them settle the question, is taking cross sections of the two long bones that remained, the humerus from the upper arm and the left femur, cutting cross sections, because there's likely to be more DNA within the bone than there is on the surface. He also extracted four teeth from the skull. And he gave these to the family. They sent them off to a DNA lab. But you know, while we're up there in this cemetery, which was so remote, by the way, that the relative who was leading us up there got lost. I mean, it's up this steep gravel road up on this hillside. I don't know how they got the backhoe up there, but they did. But anyway, so he's taking, he's using an autopsy saw to cut cross sections of the lung bones here. And this is just all the material laid out. And he's explaining to the various family members. This is one of Leoma Patterson's daughters. This is her daughter, Barbara, here. Now, so these are calipers here. And this is a PhD student who's now out at West Texas, University of West Texas. What's in San Marcos? They've just started a body research facility of their own. But because they're in Texas, not Tennessee, it can't be a farm. So theirs is the body ranch. And this young woman, Kate Spradley, who was working on her PhD at the time of this, is now on the faculty out there in San Marcos. And she's helping create the body ranch out there. But what she's doing here is she's using a 3D digitizing probe to take cranial measurements of this skull. And all those measurements are plugged into this huge database that they've built over the years at the University of Tennessee. They've also created some software, which is called 4DISC, which stands for Forensic Discriminant Function Software. So you can see why maybe they would shorten it to 4DISC. If you plug in measurements, if an unknown body, or in this case a skeleton of questionable identity is found, they can input measurements into this database, and the software can tell them with remarkable accuracy whether it's a white male or a white female, or an African American male or African American female, or Asian American, and it even breaks down into various exotic nationalities, because they have now so many measurements from so many skeletons all over the world that anthropologists are sending in, not just the body farm anthropologists, but anthropologists all over the world are now sending in measurements to this databank. So she's taking these measurements, and when she plugs these measurements into 4DISC, the software says, this is a white female, with 97%, I think, certain that this is a white female. And Dr. Bass looks at the material and also says, this is a, and Kate's explaining what she's doing. You see the expressions on these things? This is not a happy family. I mean, of course, something terrible happened in their family, but they're still very angry and suspicious, because they think that the case was not handled well 30 years ago. But I just love this picture because it came to emblemize so many things, over the next 2 years. But Kate's explaining what she's done with the software, and Dr. Bass is explaining, what he sees when he looks at the skull, and he, agrees with the software. This is a white female, and probably in her, roughly 50-ish, which was the age of Leoma Patterson. There is no dental work, so the skull had all its teeth, which is pretty remarkable, considering that there were a few cavities, but there were no fillings. Pretty remarkable that she still had all her teeth, never having, as far as we can tell, been to the dentist. I mean, it's Tennessee, so Dr. Bass says, this seems to be her. It's certainly consistent with her being, with it being her. And, so they send, so she's reburied, and it's the end of the day, and they rebury the coffin, reinter the bones, and they thank him for his good work. And then, 6 months or so later, they get this report back from the DNA lab saying, it's not her. Now, this is mitochondrial DNA, which is not as unique as nuclear DNA. I don't want to bog us down with explanations, but mitochondrial DNA, it's actually descended from bacteria. It's bacteria that have been incorporated into our cells, and they're sort of the chemical factories within our cells. But the DNA in there is not unique to each of us as individuals. There are a number of different varieties of it. But the mitochondrial DNA that we carry within us, in almost all cases, is identical to what we got from our mother. Mitochondrial DNA is passed down through the mothers. And so what they did when they sent off these bone and tooth samples to this DNA lab, They took a cheek swab from one of Leoma Patterson's daughters and one of her granddaughters and sent those in as well. And the lab says, you know, the bones in the coffin, not related to the daughter and the granddaughter. Well, as you might imagine, this caused some consternation. You know, not just within the family, but you know, but also within the legal system in Tennessee, because, you know, the case had been closed years ago. And now suddenly, you know, not only is this not Leoma Patterson, but it's an unknown person. And so instead of one mystery, there are apparently two now. So we went back up and dug her up again. What we did this time, there's that same skull, but this is February of 2006, and before we'd gone, I think it was in August of 2005, maybe. So this is the skull, and what we did is, you know, because we wanted to figure out, well, who is this mystery woman in Leoma's grave? We took the skull in to a forensic artist who's associated with the anthropology department at the University of Tennessee. So she could do a clay facial reconstruction. How many of you have seen this on TV or something? Mm-hmm. Well, quite a lot of you. Okay, so as you know, what she did is she put, I don't have a picture of this, she put tissue depth markers at all these key landmarks all over the skull so she would know how thick the clay needed to be to replicate mm-hmm. the thickness of human tissue in a white female, an adult white female. And this is what she came up with. And when I walked into the bone lab and saw this, I thought, my gosh, that is a dead ringer for Barbara, one of the daughters of Leoma Patterson. And that's a picture of Leoma Patterson. It's back and forth. But there's this DNA report saying it's not her, which is, you know, sort of startling. I mean, if we hadn't seen the reconstruction, we wouldn't have thought twice about it, but it's, you know, it was just such a striking resemblance. I mean, you could have knocked me over with a feather when I saw it. Dr. Lee Jantz, whom you saw in the video, she looked at it and she said, boy, that's really interesting. And then she said, but it's not her. The DNA says it's not her, so it can't be her. And then Kate Spradley, the PhD student who did the measurements of the bones, she said, boy, that sure looks a lot like the daughters. So because it seemed so odd that there would be such a striking resemblance, we took the clay back off the skull. And we did, you know, what in hindsight maybe we should have done first, which is to do what's called a video superimposition. We took the skull into the television studio on the University of Tennessee campus, and we aimed one camera at the skull at this angle. And so we aimed another at the photograph we had of her holding the baby. And so those are at exactly the same angle. And you can see, the line of the chin and, you know, the placement of the nasal opening and the spacing of the eyes, and the cheekbones. Things line up really, really well. Now, this is not a positive identification method. If these things didn't fit, you could say, well, yeah, that can't be her. But if they do fit, all you can say is, you know, boy, that, you know, that sure looks like it's her. But still, we have this DNA report. You know, I mean, the clay on the head looks like her, and this is this great fit. I mean, we showed it to one of the other forensic anthropologists at the university and said, you know, so same woman or not? He said, what, are you retarded? Of course it's the same woman. Which is not admissible in court. So, and Dr. Bass at this point pronounced himself 99.44% sure that it was her. But, you know, we've got this DNA report. You know, and we have this very skeptical family at this point because, you know, the DNA report has come back and said, you know, confirmed the suspicions of some of them who think that the investigation was botched from the get-go. And so we asked, the university had just hired a new molecular anthropologist. This is someone whose specialty is ancient and degraded DNA. And we asked her to look at the report from the lab that says that this is not her. And, down in the fine print, she pointed to some things in the fine print, including this line: the presence of multiple probes prohibited the identification of a single mitochondrial DNA profile. Possible explanations include that the sample is degraded. Actually, what it indicates is that the sample is contaminated. There is mitochondrial DNA from at least two people, and maybe more, indicated in these sample results. So what she said to us is, actually, all this report tells you is that they botched the test. This wasn't the appropriate test for them to do, and clearly the sample was contaminated, so the report isn't worth the paper that it's written on. So at that point, to Dr. Bass's thinking and my thinking, it's pretty definitive that it's her. But the family now has latched on to this DNA report, and they will not let go. And so now suddenly, think Dr. Bass and I are part of this conspiracy to sweep, the case under the rug. But what we did is we sent more teeth to a molecular anthropologist who has successfully gotten mitochondrial DNA out of teeth that are 10,000 years old. We thought, all right, if anybody can nail this down, it's Jason Eshelman at Trace Genetics. This is the molecular anthropologist's explanation for why the report's not good and what can happen in shoddy DNA testing. I mean, the sample itself, the DNA itself can decay. Or you can have contamination, which was the case in this instance. So we sent it to Jason Eshelman at Trace Genetics, and he works on this in what's almost like a NASA clean room. I mean, they're so scrupulous about contamination. And Jason dissolves the teeth, and does the extraction, and he says, "Boy, I'm having a hard time finding DNA in this." And so I said, "Well, did you use all the teeth?" He said, "Well, no, I just used half of a tooth." I said, "Well, we got teeth galore. Use as many teeth as you need." So he, does some more, and he says, "I'm still not finding anything." So I said, "Well, what about, bone? You want some bone?" So we sent him this 4-inch chunk of femur, and he does that. And he says, "I'm not finding anything." So he did 7 separate runs, 7 separate extractions, without finding any mitochondrial DNA. So not only, was there not, all this mitochondrial DNA that the other people found, there was nothing. And what had happened, it turns out, is that the medical examiner back in 1978, you saw how nice and shiny and white the skull and the long bones were? He simmered them in very hot water with a liberal dose of detergent and bleach, which destroyed. Now, in his defense, this is before DNA testing, so he didn't know he was destroying the DNA. But there's no DNA anywhere in the skeleton. So now we've got to try to persuade the family that even though, they have this report that says it's not her, it's almost certainly her, and they just really need to look at all this other evidence instead. But we're not looking forward to this meeting. It's going to be really heavy sledding, because they've gotten so worked up at this point. Well, the night before we had this meeting with the family, I got a call from the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation agent who had worked the case, back in the 70s. He had been looking through his files, because I'd called him up and asked him a lot of questions. And he found in his basement his original evidence file that had been sent back to him from the TBI lab. And in it was the hair mat, which had not been simmered in detergent and bleach. And there was still scalp tissue attached to that. So we overnighted a chunk of that out to Jason at Trace Genetics. And of course, there's mitochondrial DNA galore in that. And he says, yes, it is her. There's this unusual mutation at this point on the DNA sequence, and that same mutation is in the granddaughter whose cheek swab we sent to him for comparison. This took 2 years. If this had been on CSI, it would have taken, 40 minutes. But this actually took 2 years. But it was fascinating. We actually were writing about this. It was the last chapter in Beyond the Body Farm, and as the manuscript was, as we were proofreading the manuscript just before it came out, we still didn't know. We hadn't, we hadn't found the hair mat. And so we wrote this sort of nebulous ending about wishing we could give them some resolution, and we were felt confident, but we couldn't scientifically prove it. And so then, we literally got to say stop the presses, and we rewrote the ending of the book. But The sad thing is, some of the family still does not believe it, and they still think they've been wronged. They think they're still being wronged. So, we're human beings, and I guess we all live according to our lights the best we can.
Where is she now?
She has been reburied yet again. Some of them accept that it is her, and others still think that there's this big conspiracy.
I was going to say, did they find who killed her?
They had a confession back in the late 70s, the early 80s. A nephew of hers said he had killed her during a drug deal, gone bad. And in fact, he and his father were the last two men seen with her alive. Those were the two men she left this bar with. Now, his father's recently died. Jimmy Ray is in prison in Georgia doing life for another murder. He pled guilty to manslaughter and got 6 years for this, concurrently with his life sentence in Georgia. But then now he's, after the DNA report, the first faulty DNA report came out, he said, "I don't know nothing about no killing." So he recanted, and he's trying to get a new hearing or trial. I mean, it's just a big mess. But anyway, his father recently died, and so now he's sort of intimating, well, maybe it was my dad. I'm going to stop, and we have time, I hope, for a few questions. I'm sorry if I've droned on too long for questions. Anybody, questions? Yes?
Could they establish the cause of death for skeletal remains?
There was no skeletal trauma. No, there was no way to tell how she died. Now, one thing that might have helped, the medical examiner in this case kept the hyoid bone, which is this little U-shaped bone in your throat. And if you are strangled, there's a fair chance that your hyoid bone is going to be fractured. Well, in his autopsy or his forensic examination of the bones at the time, he noted that there were possible fractures in the hyoid. But he lost the hyoid. So there's no way to confirm it. Any other? Yes, sir.
Yeah, can you talk a bit about how you get the plots for your books, particularly the most recent one?
I've done very poor salesmanship. I haven't told you what a fabulous, fabulous book Bones of Betrayal is. Yeah. But it's set in Oak Ridge, which was the cradle of the atomic bomb in World War II. We wanted to really feature this historic period in Oak Ridge's history, life, because that was its real moment of glory on the world stage. It went from being this collection of sleepy little farming settlements to being this boom town, literally, of 75,000 people working three shifts a day, huge plants, people churning out material for the atomic bombs, but not knowing that that's what they're doing. So we wanted to really feature that period. But we couldn't open the book then, because our hero, Dr. Bill Brockton, who's fairly closely based on Dr. Bass, except has some of my, it's like Dr. Bass is scientific knowledge with all of my, sort of moral and intellectual failings. he wasn't around solving crimes, fictionally, in 1945. And so we open with a modern murder, and as that murder is being investigated, that brings to light a murder that happened back in 1945 and was successfully concealed. Yes, ma'am?
I lived in Oak Ridge during that time.
Did you, really?
My father worked in one of those plants.
Uh-huh.
And did not know. We woke him up the day the atomic bomb was dropped and told him what was going on.
Now which of the plants did he work in?
I don't remember. It was Y-12 and K-25, but I don't remember which one.
Okay, so one of the uranium enrichment plants. Yes. Yeah.
And
yeah.
He said when they would have a leak, didn't know what they were doing, but when they would have a leak on the line, they had to put on lead line suits to go in and repair it.
Oh, so he was probably working in the K-25 plant, which used the gaseous diffusion process to enrich uranium. The other plant used these cyclotrons, these giant cyclotrons called calutrons, that literally atom by atom, electromagnetically separated the uranium-238 from the uranium-235.
But it was a miracle.
It was amazing. It was amazing. I worked in Oak Ridge for about 15 years. And, Oak Ridge is marvelous, and it is also scary as hell. It's like the best and the worst of us. It's these brilliant minds, focused intently on creating more and more efficient ways of killing lots of people. So we have an if you get the book, there's a picture just inside where part one starts. There's a picture of a young woman at the controls of one of these uranium separation cyclotrons. They were called Calutron girls. They were hired right out of high school. They had no idea what they were doing. They were just supposed to, you know, work levers and knobs and keep needles pointed at certain numbers. But they literally, you know, were winnowing uranium on the atomic threshing floor. So it was a fascinating story to write. And then the Calutron girl that's in the picture, I mean, she was sort of an inspiration for a character who plays a major role. I mean, she's now an old woman in her late 80s. You know, the fictional character in modern day Ocritz is this old woman. But she tells stories to Dr. Brockton. She's kind of our guide or, you know, through the doorway of the past.
I can't wait to read the book.
Well, thank you.
One I recognize.
Great, thank you. Okay, ladies first.
Do you have other documentaries other than this, and particularly how did you get involved in the one on the Vatican?
I was working at a television production company that, it's like the rest of life, you know, sort of, it's who you know that matters. And so the guy that owned this television production company that I was working for knew somebody that had some weird connection to the Vatican, and so, you know, got permission to send this documentary crew in. I happened to work on it because they gave it to three other producers and writers before me, and they couldn't figure out what to make.
And is that on National Geographic?
No, that was A&E, the Arts and Entertainment Network. Beautiful, lavish footage of the Vatican, which is an amazing place, but also a little scary in some ways too.
I'm a fan of CS9. How true do you think the forensic work?
There's a lot of license. There is, yeah. I mean, I can't dissect specific episodes because I've only seen two or three, and every time I've gotten so enraged, I've snapped the television. I mean, there's one. You saw what happened to this guy out at the body farm, you know. And I mean, like, literally within 24 hours, he's swelling up and he's crawling with maggots. So I watched a CSI, and there's this woman is killed, and she's left on a rooftop in Las Vegas. Not exactly a, you know, chilly place. You know, so things are going to happen fast. But, you know, according to the show, they find her like 24 hours later, and she's in a bikini on this rooftop, and she looks like this Victoria's Secret model. You know, there's a sort of artful little trickle of blood coming out one corner of her mouth. But she's gorgeous. You know, and, you know, that ain't how it works. Yes, sir.
So when does the body farm become a series?
Well, we actually, 2 years ago, we were reviewing contracts from Warner Brothers for a television series. And as we were literally about to put pen to paper, the writer's strike, big long writer's strike hit. And by the time it ended, for reasons that make sense in Hollywood, but not to us, the momentum for the project was gone. Now we have another nibble right now, you know, for a possible TV series and a nibble for film rights to the first three novels. But, you know, they're just nibbles at this point, and so we'll believe it when we, you know, see them on the screen. But I think it'd be a great show because, you know, not only do you have the, you know, the murder angle and the interaction of anthropologists, you know, scientists and cops, you know, but you also have, you know, these academics, you know, the sort of the ivory tower. Well, I won't say Peyton Place because we have some faculty members here, and, you know, I don't want to, you know, seem to be casting any aspersions, but, you know, it's an interesting world, the university, you know, and when you merge that world with the world of law enforcement, and you have, you know, professors and cops and graduate students who are, you know, sleeping in their office cubicles so they can work more hours, and you got undergraduates. I mean, you have a lot more layers you can work. I think it would be really rich material.
No, wait, one question back here.
Yes, I wondered if y'all were working on the next one.
We are just about to be. It's due in a frighteningly short time.
Well, that's what I figured. You're coming out, and it seems to be good.
Once a year. The first Tuesday, randomly enough, the first Tuesday of every February. We are what's called, this is, you know, sort of both thrilling and very humbling. We are now what's known as franchise authors, so, which just underscores, you know, to the publishers, this is product.
Yeah.
You know, it's a commodity, and they want that commodity once a year. So, but we have some interesting ideas. We actually, you know, as we were driving around on book tour, and I'll say again, I'm so sorry that, you know, the book tour kind of wore out Dr. Bass before we got him here. But as we were driving around on book tour, we were kicking around ideas for the next one. And we had some really interesting, you know, cool, fun, you know, sort of amazing and scary ideas. Thank you so much. It's been a really nice.
Again, on behalf of WKU Libraries and the Kentucky Museum, we want to thank you for joining us in another Kentucky Live production. We want to remind you that we're going to be signing books just outside the door momentarily, and hope you'll stop by and chat with John. Again, our pleasure, John, to have you here.